Hello and welcome to The Menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. In the next 30 minutes, Marugame Udon is one of the best known brands in Japan, and now the restaurant chain has ambitious plans for Europe. We'll find out more shortly.
The bar's set really high because in Japan, this brand is sort of ranked number 14 out of all the brands in Japan. In fact, it's one higher than the iPhone.
Then we head to Scotland to hear about the constant innovation taking place in the world of whisky.
We're not restricted by the Scotch whisky definition and what that previous fill is, as long as it doesn't detract from the complexity, the richness and the flavour of Scotch whisky.
All that plus the week's top headlines and Arena soundtrack recommendation ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. The world's largest udon noodle chain, Marugame Udon, is hard to miss in many Asian cities. The brand currently has over 800 restaurants in Japan and a further 250 across Asia, the USA and Russia. And the brand has set out ambitious plans for taking over Europe next. Keith Bird is in charge of the expansion in this part of the world. He caught up with me a bit earlier to discuss what kind of tweaks are required to make the brand succeed in Europe, what he's learned from the launches so far, and how Marugame Udon could become a household name here too. Let's have a listen.
In one sense, we started off probably a month before the pandemic came, because we actually flew over to Japan to talk to the Toradol team who own the Marugame brand. They've got some other brands, but Marugame is the key brand that they have. And so there was this thing happening in China, and everyone's, oh, I wonder what that is. So should we go ahead with the flight, or should we put it off a couple of weeks? And we decided to progress. And then we met the team, and there was a great meeting of minds. And we saw a lot of these fantastic udon shops in Tokyo, and just thought, yeah, that absolutely would translate over to the European market with some tweaks and changes. So we got back on the flight, everyone's quite excited, and then of course the narrative and the script starts changing, as we all know now. However, when you've got something that you think is a really great idea, you know, you just keep going with it. And although when you look to launch a new business in a new market, you'd want to be quite close with the founders or the brand owners. But what we were able to do was to connect up using Teams and really keep the progress going in terms of the opportunities to learn, adapt and get ready for that launch. So it was an interesting time. First of all, closing the deal, which, you know, you've got to be bold at that point in the midst of the pandemic. But as you know, so Captisia are the partners in Europe, and Toradol. Absolutely, this is a commitment when you open restaurants for 15 years. Mm. So the reality is we felt that there was still this great opportunity in Europe, and we were going to prepare and get ourselves really ready.
Keith, you have a lot of experience from the industry, from launching businesses and helping businesses to establish themselves in different parts of the world. It's interesting you mentioned those tweaks and changes to the concept when you're thinking about launching. In the UK, for example, what kind of things did you adjust?
Yeah, it's interesting because in one sense, having worked with other big brands, KFC, Pizza Hut, everyone thinks it's the same the world over, but there are alterations and adjustments that do take place. So if you look at KFC in Indonesia, you know, it's all about rice and chicken, etc., which people wouldn't normally expect to be the case. But there are these adjustments. So looking at such a strong brand in Japan, what we wanted to do is to start from a sense of some good market research, talk to customers, see what they understand. And of course, udon, what's udon? So some really interesting pieces where we had to sort of get under the skin and really understand what customers truly understood and what they didn't. And I think when you do research like that, you also want to make sure that to get people to come in and try a product, you want to make sure there are what I always call some crossover products that help people on that. So whereas the menu and the dishes that are there in Japan are fantastic for the Japanese consumers, you do need to make some adjustments to make it relevant for European customers as well.
Tell me about that. So the restaurant experience, I would imagine that when people go to the restaurant in London now, they may see different things over there first compared to what the Japanese customers in Japan might see.
Absolutely. So in terms of the design elements, what we knew is in Japan, it's a very traditional build. So it's very wood and it's very functional and it's, you know, a fantastic environment for the Japanese consumers. But we definitely felt that for European customers, there needs to be a little bit more in terms of that. So we've sort of created what we think are some really nice udon lighting that's in there. We've got the traditional slates that you'd have over the roofs. We've sort of done a design that's different on there. Another thing is we've got music. So actually in Japan, they don't have music. And that's because people come in, eat quickly and leave. But for our European customer base, we felt we needed to create that element where the ambience is right, as well as fantastic food. So that's the obvious of lights down, music up a bit, and that music is curated, where you have obviously some J-pop, some K-pop, some genre music, and some crowd pleasers as well, to sort of try and create a really interesting environment that people want to be in. And that's certainly been the case since we opened.
So the market research, you wanted to find out how much people know about what you're offering and what you're serving. And I would imagine that udon is not mainstream enough for very many people to know. Did that mean that you had to adjust the menu a little bit as well?
Yeah, so one of the things, 30% of our menu is vegan over here. But in Japan, the awareness is very, very low there. So we knew we had to do that for the consumers. But also in the same way, we needed to get these crossover products that made it easy for customers. So chicken katsu is a really strong one for us. Yaki udon as well, or chicken teriyaki. You know, these are ones that people know. And then, of course, that then creates the segue or the connection that once people have come in and tried the safe products that they know, then they get the chance to be more adventurous, etc., in terms of trying some of the more traditional Japanese udon dishes. But one that really did surprise us is there's a traditional dish, a kake dish, which is really light, beautiful dish, udon. And, you know, that's been in our sort of top three or four dishes. Now, of course, we have it as chef recommendations. So that's an important thing. And the price is £4.45. And that makes it an easy one for people to come in and try. But actually, that since the first day has been one that people have flocked to, loved, and it's great for lunchtime. A light, easy, I think it's 340 calories. So it's a really light, you know, beautiful, well-balanced tasting dish. So that seems to have been a real, more of a crowd pleaser than we originally thought.
So we're talking about a franchise business. I'm wondering how much support did you get from Japan? I understand you flew over some staff members from there to help you.
We did, especially for the launch. So we had what Torridor call a star team. So we had four people fly over and just help us for around sort of 3 months to make sure all our teams were properly trained up, that the standards are there. And even better than that, we had our udon master, who's called Kosan, who's come over for a minimum of sort of 5 years with us, some say on a one-way ticket. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, he's fantastic. So to perfect udon and the flavour of the udon and making sure that the balance is exactly there, you know, that's what he's here for, you know, to maintain that quality, drive that quality. Especially as you open many stores, you want to make sure that that consistency, that quality is absolutely there. And his objective is to make sure it's the world's best udon.
And you are very ambitious. You are going to open many restaurants over here, both in the UK and also in Europe. What kind of plans do you have for the future?
Yeah, we're really excited. In one sense, I'd say, look, we're really ambitious and we're bold and we want to grow fast, but we're also really humble, because you have to make sure each service, each customer at a time has an amazing experience, and each shop or kitchen is delivered to the best possible standards. But yeah, the ambition's there. We clearly want to get into Europe. Our first step was launching and establishing the brand in the UK, and that's gone really well. We've got four restaurants open at the moment, which are all doing really, really well. Now's the acceleration time, get some UK franchise partners. And then, you know, so excited about getting out to France, Spain, Germany, Finland, mm-hmm. clearly in honour of yourself, Marcus, there. But, you know, it's really exciting that we get a chance to take what is such a fantastic dish and type of food that people may not have heard before and put it in a way that's really relevant for them.
Exactly. We're talking about things that people may not be awfully familiar with. And I'm wondering, I would imagine one big challenge for you at the moment is to make this brand better known both in the UK and also in Europe. So what's the plan? How do you do that?
It's a really great question, because also the bar's set really high, because in Japan, this brand is sort of ranked number 14 out of all the brands in Japan. In fact, it's one higher than the iPhone, which always blows my mind. So we knew the expectations were really high. What we didn't quite expect was to see, when we opened in London, quite how many customers really already knew Marugame, just because sometimes we as Europeans may not have. But actually, if you've lived in Hong Kong, Philippines, Indonesia, you have. So actually, there's a great amount of awareness there. And of course, what we needed to do is to make sure we launched it in a really effective way. So in the UK, actually, before we opened, we created a Windows for Japan exhibition, which was really good fun. Because what we knew is, when you launch a brand, you get one chance and you have to make sure that you connect with the right customer group. So we had lots of windows that were then showing some of the Japanese calligraphy, origami, lots of different elements. Actually, we also had a live stream straight into one of the kitchens in Tokyo. So that was really great fun. We also had another, we put up these massive screens in the window that actually would project you into various images of Japan. So because nobody could travel at that time, it was trying to get the sense of that wanderlust. I love traveling. Most people love traveling. So here was this opportunity to stand in front. The camera would take your image and project you into one of the torii or into a taxi in the middle of Tokyo. So it's a lovely way of engaging, and people were then doing selfies and sharing it around. So actually that built up an amazing awareness, such that when we did open, we ended up with a queue that must have been about 400, 500 metres long, and people waiting 2 hours to come into Marugame. Of course, lots didn't join the end of the queue. But that was fabulous, you know, having launched, I think, the week after Freedom Day.
Just finally, as I mentioned, we're talking about a franchise business, and your expansion to continental Europe depends on finding the right partners. This may sound like a dating show question, but what kind of partners are you looking for? What makes for an ideal partner in that sense in business?
It's an interesting analogy, because you're looking for a relationship, really, and ultimately you're looking for a partnership that's going to last many, many, many years. So for us, it's about understanding customers who share our same values, ones that often have experience of being a multi-site operator, because you need someone who knows what it takes to actually deliver multi-units, you know, multi-kitchens. And I think that's really important. Great if they've already worked with brands, because they understand what franchising's about. I think that's an important thing. Not the only thing, but I think also knowing that they know how to grow businesses effectively as well. So they're the sort of the key elements in there. But probably it all starts off with the value system, you know, that actually they really understand the care, the love, the attention that has to go into delivering the best possible udon.
Keith Bird there. He is the CEO for Europe Marugame Udon. You are listening to Monocle 24. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maylee Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. First up to Paris, where this week there's a festival in town which will help city dwellers reconnect food to agriculture. Eat and Save the Planet will show attendees new alternative models for food systems and how to integrate changes into their lives. Elsewhere, Los Angeles has welcomed its first museum dedicated to Mexican food. LA Plaza Cocina is situated downtown in the city, and the museum's first exhibit offers visitors a chance to explore the contribution of Mexico's indigenous corn to the world. And finally, the world's largest igloo cafe has opened in Kashmir. The cafe sits at an altitude of 2,500 metres in the Himalayas, where it serves coffee, chocolate and snacks. But if you want to visit, you better be quick. The cafe is expected to melt away sometime next month. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maylee. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Before this week's Dinner Sounds Rec recommendation, we head to Scotland. Rachel Barry is one of the very few master blenders in the world of whisky. Working for Brown-Forman, she has developed award-winning whiskies for some of the most appreciated names in the industry. One of her special projects has been the creation of Glendorock 50, a 50-year-old single malt which is the oldest Glendorock has ever released. Rachel spoke to me a bit earlier to discuss this, new trends in whiskey and why you have to be sure where you buy your wood from. But first, she told me how a medicine and chemistry student became one of the world's best known whiskey professionals.
I mean, a combination of coming from a whiskey loving background and also a good dose of fate and luck. I grew up in distilling country near Glendronach, where I was born and bred. And I often, you know, sampled my father's collection of single malts. And at university, I collected miniatures of single malt to kind of work my way around the distillery. So I was a real hobbyist about whiskey. And at university, I first studied medicine and then transferred to chemistry. And after that, I kind of thought I would probably go into more pharmaceuticals or oil. I honestly didn't know you could get a job working in whiskey, or I would have been right there immediately. But it was just the last day I was cycling past the career service at Edinburgh University, and I popped in, and it was the very last day that a job was advertised at the Scotch Whiskey Research Institute as a research scientist. And fate would have it, I got the job, and I've never looked back since.
Amazing. And nowadays you work as a master blender. What exactly does your work consist of at the moment?
Oh, well, I mean, the master blender's role is incredibly varied. I love variety, and that's probably why I've ended up in this role, because as a master blender, you have to get involved in everything from the barley in the field, the spirit off the still, the hundreds of thousands of casks maturing in the warehouse, right through to the whiskey going out the door and introducing the consumer to it, whether in tastings or in the copy that we write on the packaging. So you really have a touch point in every single part of the process, which is wonderful and is also the reason why no 2 days are the same. So I could be nosing the distillates from the still, you know, first thing in the morning from all three distilleries against our kind of gold standard to make sure that we produce the best quality every single time. And then I could be working with the brand team, coming up with new ideas or ways of talking about whiskey, working on a new range. Or indeed, I could be in our stock profile, sampling the casks and also working out long-term strategy, you know, looking ahead for the next 20, 30 years or more as to what whiskey we're going to make, what wood it's going to go into, and which expressions in the portfolio are going to be released for the consumer to enjoy and hopefully grow the business aligned to that in different markets. So it could be any of these things.
Keeps you busy, certainly. I'm wondering, when you work for a great distillery, what are the most challenging aspects of that work?
Well, you know, a great distillery is going to taste amazing. It's going to have the highest quality every step of the way. I think the biggest challenge is making sure we make enough whiskey, because if you have a great distillery, chances are, no one has a crystal ball, but years in the future, we probably won't have made enough today for the growth. So I think predicting how much you need to distill is a big challenge. But in addition to that, you know, sustainability is a challenge, making sure that we have the highest quality ingredients year after year and buying the best quality wood, for example, and make sure we actually get the deliveries on time to fill the wood. And of course, that has been a real challenge in the past couple of years, has actually been getting shipments in on time. So we've kind of had to be very agile and rethink how to do that, and often buy wood well in advance so we make sure that we get it in time for the spirit coming off the still.
It's interesting to hear that from you, considering that so many other different industries have been saying the same thing, how hard it is to source, for example, wood or ingredients from around the world. Where does your wood come from, for example?
For Glendronach, we have, you know, the probably the most expensive casks in the industry coming from Andalusia in southern Spain. And these are sherry casks. They're unusually made of Spanish oak, which is incredibly rare and expensive. And we use principally Pedro Ximenez and Oloroso sherry casks, the king of sherry and arguably the richest casks in the industry. So it's really, really critically important to the business that we guarantee the sustainability of supply of sherry casks. For Benriach, however, we use a lot of American oak bourbon casks, you know, principally from Jack Daniel's distillery, as well as virgin oak. And again, you know, we should definitely have a sustainable supply there because we're part of the same group in Brown-Forman. So we have access to, you know, very, very high quality wood there. And then I source from around the world as well, either directly or through brokers. Cast everything for Benriach from Marsala in Sicily to port from Portugal, rum from Jamaica, and French wines as well from Bordeaux, Burgundy, and Spanish wine such as Rioja. So the world is our oyster, really, in sourcing wood. And that's the world of flavour out there, working in harmony with the distillery character, really kind of opens the opportunities, the possibilities for innovation going forwards.
What kind of innovation is taking place at the moment in the industry? Obviously, you've been keeping an eye on the whiskey world for decades now. How much is changing at the moment? How much innovation and new ideas do you see at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, the whiskey industry is really opening up. I think, you know, it's like the wine world in the 1980s, you know, really just starting to open up and the consumers start to understand what's the difference between, you know, a fruity whiskey and a smoky whiskey, a Speyside or, you know, a Highland Malt, an Islay, and all of these traditional, I suppose, aspects of Scotch. However, the consumer is just now really learning about it. And obviously the internet and communication, the interconnectedness of the world, that really is a platform to innovate for people to really understand about malt whiskey and what we can do. The main lever that we can work with is the oak cask. You know, it must be made of oak. Oak is actually the highest quality wood in the world. I've tried other woods in the past, many, many years ago. And because of trying to protect the quality of Scotch and the, you know, the Scotch whisky definition, it must be made of oak because it is the richest, most exquisite character of wood that can be used for maturation. But other than that, you know, we can use virgin oak from different parts of the world, from Japan or from Central Europe to America, South America, wherever. You know, we can source quality oak from a variety of places in the world. And we're not restricted by the Scotch whisky definition and what that previous fill is, as long as it was something that has been done, that the spirit is matured and it is part of its process. And also that it doesn't detract from the complexity, the richness and the flavour of Scotch whisky, which is of paramount importance to maintain the high quality standards.
Now, there's been a big milestone for the Glendronach distillery. We should discuss the release of its first ever 50-year-old single malt. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was around a month ago we launched the Glendronach 50 years old, which is the oldest expression ever to have been released by the Glendronach distillery. It was just an incredible, momentous occasion because, you know, it's the first, it's reached this grand old age, and creating that whiskey, you know, working with it was intense. And, you know, I was really looking to create the ultimate expression of Glendronach. 1971 was when it was distilled on one single day. So 25th of February, 1971. And that day, decades ago, was probably snowy and blustery as it is just now. And that moment in time over 50 long years has been transformed into a symphony of flavour, of silk and velvet, just seamlessly intertwining in the glass. It's something that is truly, truly remarkable.
Amazing. I'm wondering, when you were working in that project, for example, how much did you have to think about the customers, people buying that? Or do you do your work trying not to think about that?
It always, for me, being a master blender, is one of the most joint-up roles in the industry. So inside the mind of a master blender, you have to be a consumer first and foremost yourself. and really have your finger on the pulse. Be aware, be open to the world around you. See what's happening, sense what's, you know, happening in the world, and also use your own gut and intuition. And it's kind of all woven together in creativity, because, you know, you'll have an idea of a taste, a flavor, you know, even sometimes an image of the place itself or the atmosphere surrounding you when you're at the distillery. And it then transforms into what you will create. So the casks that you might transfer the spirit into that might take it in a certain direction. It's a combination of insights, I suppose, as well as the intuitive sense of smell. You know, I say the nose knows, because, you know, if you've nosed hundreds of thousands of casks, you know, you kind of get to know what works and you get to know the consumer as well. So it really is a fusion of both. You know, it's so intertwined, you can't really pull it apart.
You mentioned that this connection is very important, that you have to keep your finger on the pulse to understand where the world is at the moment. How do you make sure you do that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's horizon watching, isn't it? It's through friends around the world, colleagues around the world. I mean, I'm very lucky to work with people in almost every country that I speak to, you know, from Australia to Japan to Taiwan and all over America and Europe. You know, you get the insights from all the locals in their own regions as to what's working, you know, what people are enjoying, what their tastes are. And, you know, apart from the past couple of years, obviously, I've traveled extensively with work. It was more of an ambassadorial role as well as the production side. But that is so important for discovering the richness of culture, of heritage and customs from other parts of the world. I think it's so important to really keep learning and discovering, because that's where all the bright ideas come from. Quite often it's informed by other places or new things you've learned.
You've been working in the industry for almost 3 decades now. I'm wondering, what has it been like for a woman? I would imagine that whiskey world is very much dominated by men. Is that changing, and what's been your experience like?
Yeah, I think it's been a pretty much a seismic change, actually, probably in the past decade. You know, going back in time, when I was starting out in the early 1990s, in research, it was quite gender balanced, actually, in the research environment, you know, more scientific and analytical. And then when I moved into production, there were pockets, you know, of marketing was more female, or on the bottling line was more female. But whereas the area I went into was most definitely male dominated, because that was distilling, wood sourcing, blending and warehousing, which was, you know, very male dominated. Also, there were very few senior role models at that point, I would say. Whereas now, today, you know, there's probably about 50% of master blenders in Scotland are actually female. It's probably closer to 50-50. You know, it's remarkable to think that I was the first female to get the title in 2003, and now it's about 50-50. So it's been, you know, quite a seismic change, and a senior level as well. Our senior leadership team, for example, is around about 60% female, 40% male. And, you know, that's just, you know, the best people for the job. It's good for everyone, really, that we all learn from each other. We've got, you know, very diverse range of people as well. It has changed a lot, which is a good thing.
Just finally, Rachel, I'm wondering, after having worked in the industry so much, is there something you would like to change?
Oh, gosh. Every day I like to change something. I'm a bit disruptive that way. Whatever it might be. I think, you know, looking forwards, I mean, I just like more people to know that there are jobs in the industry. I think even just, you know, it's like when I was at university, I hadn't a clue that you could work in the spirits industry, and definitely not in the whiskey industry. So I think we need to do a better job of sharing our experiences, of sharing that it's a great place to work, of really inviting people in, whether they're analytical or creative or whatever their particular strength is, to really show that there is really a job for everyone. And it's a great place to work. You know, it's incredibly fun. It's very welcoming and friendly. You know, we're working with the best spirit in the world here. There's a great working environment. I think we need to do a better job there.
Master Blender Rachel Barry there, and that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here are Flume and Meya with Say Nothing. Thanks for listening.